Welcome to Britain's only weekly FM radio programme about transport and design. Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden. We're chatting art, transport, communications history. That's C-A-T-C-H. It's the Couchcast. In this edition, who would get excited about a timetable? Do you know they had really interesting covers and very clever maps? And what's the point of a timetable if it's out of date? Today's guest has all the answers. Welcome to the Couchcast, Matthew Shaw.
Hello, Mark.
Thank you so much for being here, Matthew. And we're going to discuss your most excellent website, timetableworld.com, and your recent move into book publishing too. But I wonder if we can start by talking about some of the things you did sort of early on in life. Were you fascinated by data like timetables when you were a kid?
I wouldn't say that I was particularly. I think my main passion early in life was with maps, and I would spend time drawing those as a child. When I got to the age of about 11, that I started train spotting, as many youngsters do. Mm-hmm. Our school was next to the railway line, and it was something that everyone did. And from there, we started travelling around the railways using the timetables. And it was really just over a period of time that I gained familiarity with using timetables as a way of facilitating travel. When I got to the age of 18, that was the first time I did one of these Interrail tickets travelling around Europe.
Ah.
At the time, you would go with a timetable. And my approach was really to go with no plan. I would jump on a train with a timetable and would be working out, well, where shall I go next? And that has been a very fruitful way of rail touring, really, is to go without a plan but with a timetable.
People would be doing that using their apps nowadays, wouldn't they? It's not quite as much fun as a proper big thick timetable of all European trains.
The opportunities come to you when you're travelling with a timetable book. With an app, you kind of have to know where you want to go, and it'll tell you the times that are available. But my approach was really to explore branch lines. I would say, oh, there's a branch line there, and if I get off this train, then there will be a connecting one. And I would use the timetable to discover a country.
Happier times, happier times. And I believe when you started your career, how were you involved with IT at that point?
Well, I started my working career in 1981. And although there were mainframe computers, the idea of the personal computer hadn't arrived, and I didn't know that I was interested in IT anyway at the time. But it was around 1985 that I got a job working for Mars Confectionery, as it was, in Slough. And I was taken on with a view to becoming an accountant. So I had a super business training working for Mars and some fantastic colleagues who've gone on to great things. Whilst I was there, I was training to be a management accountant. But one of the beauties of the job was that I would be busy preparing management accounts every 4 weeks, but then had time to develop and to explore. Now, in 1985, I was given a personal computer. I had never really seen one before, and there was very little software that would run on a computer. But they gave me this PC, and I was left to spend time working out, well, how am I going to use this to make the job more effective? Even though I was still studying for my accountancy exams, I came to realise that I was enjoying the IT work more than actually doing the accounting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when I did get my qualification, I decided, well, I would actually move on to another organisation. So I became a financial management consultant for a company that's now EY, Ernst & Young. And they would send me around to the country, and my PC skills were still quite rare at the time because it was all quite new. So I found that I was able to get some quite interesting jobs and was able to do things that were still unfamiliar to a lot of people.
And I believe that led to almost a decade with UBS.
Well, there was an intermediate step. After I left Ernst & Young, I spent 6 years working for Oracle. So by that time, I decided, yes, IT was what I wanted to do. And so I was still a consultant. I was still travelling around. But I was now seen as an IT consultant. But as you say, I did go to UBS, the investment bank in London. and they were a client. Having had many years of touring, I had by that time a family. I wanted to be a bit more rooted at home. So getting a job in the City of London, using my technical skills, was a fantastic opportunity. So yes, I spent nearly a decade working in a team of mathematicians in what's called the front office. They would shout across the desk what they wanted, and my job as their IT support was to turn things around in as little time as possible.
And I believe it was at the time following the credit crunch in 2008 that you began working with something called open source software.
Well, I did get made redundant from, as did a lot of people from investment banking in 2008. And I spent 10 months before I managed to get back into work. So that was a great opportunity to explore what's called open source software. This is where volunteers have written code and they make it free, and if you wish you can contribute to the open source project. So I was using my time hopefully developing my skills whilst I was trying to find a job. There weren't many jobs out there, so I probably spent 80% of my time not job hunting.
And tell us about online mapping, please, Matthew. Can you explain what you call the tile pyramids? What are they about?
Yeah, well, what I wanted to achieve with open source software was to understand how to build a website, and more particularly how to put a map online. The challenge with a map is that it's huge. A map of the world in great detail is far too big for somebody to put onto a computer. But a tile pyramid works by breaking up the map into little squares, which are called pyramids. And you have a square covering a particular part of the world. But then you would take four of those and reduce them in size to make a new fifth pyramid above that. You repeat the process up to one tile that will cover the whole world. And why this is important is that when somebody is then browsing a map, they can start at one level and only download the little bit of the map that they need. And as they zoom into it, they just retrieve the tiles that are needed. And at a time, considering that we're talking about 2010, this was very important for managing the limited bandwidth that people had on their internet connections. And later, when mobile phones became prevalent, it's the only way you could actually put a map online was by breaking it up into small pieces that could be handled. The tile pyramid was something that I got to the bottom of in 2010 on how it works and why it's important. Wow. And it has underpinned most of the projects I've worked on since.
Wow. Today we're talking with Matthew Shaw about a website he started that has become a real beacon for transport lovers. Please give us an idea how it all started off, Matthew.
So when I'd been experimenting with open source software, I thought, well, this needs to have a purpose. So I thought, well, I'm quite interested in maps. I'm interested in timetables. So I registered a website, timetableworld.com, built my first website, put some maps on it, and put some timetables on it. Not very many, but it was a start, and it gave some shape to me working on open source software.
Tell us what it looked like when it launched in 2010.
So the first version of Timetable World had probably 15 timetables on it. It was linked to Google Maps, and it was using a very early version of the tile pyramid concept to enable a big timetable to be viewed on a computer through limited bandwidth.
So you first set up the website in 2010, but storing all the images, I think, was a bit of an issue for you. How did you and your team overcome that?
The solutions that I had in 2010 were heavily constrained. It was too expensive to store any more than the 15 timetables that I had. And so that's where the website went into hibernation, effectively. Although it was still online, I wasn't working on it for quite a number of years. But come 2015, I moved into semi-retirement. And the first job I wanted to do was bring the hosting of the website to my home. That was now possible because I had a decent broadband connection. And it coincided with my son being at university studying electronics. So we actually built a server to host the website and indeed underpin other projects I wanted to do. So my son was very helpful in building that server for me. I was interested in the software side rather than the hardware, so it was a good collaboration. But although I had the timetables website, I was still very interested in maps. And I thought a good project that would interest me was to try and put a big map online. There was the maps that had been produced in the Soviet Union of the world had become available some years prior, and it was possible to download tens of thousands of these from other websites. But the limitation was that they all had borders on them. They were printed in many cases 40, 50 years ago. So my project was really to turn those into an online map, rather like Google Maps is, something that would allow you to look at what the Soviets saw alongside a contemporary map. And that was my first project. It would have involved using the server very fully because of the volume of storage involved. And I got to meet a chap called John Davis, who you interviewed a few weeks ago, because he was something of a font of knowledge on the Soviet mapping. And we started the collaboration to put the Soviet maps onto a moving map. I progressed that, but unfortunately someone got there first. So I decided, oh no, even though I'd achieved a lot in terms of understanding how to do this, someone did get there first. Yes, so I thought, all right, I'll move on and do something else.
Because I understand at the same sort of time you got some pretty valuable lessons from working with a local museum's website.
Yes. I was working at my local museum in Maidenhead. I was helping with the website. I was putting the catalogue online. So I learned a fair amount about archiving from the curator there. And we did have a project to put the museum's collection of local maps online. We also had a very interesting archive dating from World War II for the Air Transport Auxiliary, which was headquartered here in Maidenhead. So there was a big collection of pilots' logbooks and various documents that were ideal for this tile pyramid concept that we talked about earlier, because they were large and would enable people, by putting those online, it would enable people to look at a whole logbook and drill into it. So that was an interesting project that's still out there.
And I think during COVID, you talked to your users of timetableworld.com and asked them what you could do to relaunch the website. Is that correct?
Well, I wasn't really in touch with the users, so I actually used a forum. It occurred to me that during COVID, I was going to be at home rather a lot, so let's find a project that I could build on. And I thought, well, let's find out whether people are interested in Timetable World being built up. So I engaged on one of the relevant forums. People said, yeah, it's interesting, but there's not much material on there. So I thought, well, I can actually build this up now that we're no longer constrained by the amount of storage. But the other part was that I'd recognised that it was actually quite a lot of work to do the indexing and the scanning. And people were out there with time on their hands. So part of the thinking was that rather than trying to do everything myself, as I had before, I would use volunteers. And that's an important part of how we've gone about Timetable World, is that I've built screens on the website that allow users working at home at times that suit them to index the timetables so that it becomes easier to jump around and find what you're looking for. I even had one volunteer who did a huge amount of scanning during the COVID period. I wasn't given a choice, to be honest. He turned up and said, right, I'm going to do some scanning for you. And so, yes, we had a very productive period of working where clearly nobody could go out very much, and so he was happy scanning and I was happy using what he did.
There's a lot of us out here who love maps and love what you do, but I wonder, where do you get, apart from these volunteers that are helping you so kindly, where do you get all your material from?
Almost all of it comes from private collectors who loan the material, but these days most of them are donations and bequests and the like, and the donations have become larger and larger. They can get to being carloads now. I took a trip over to the continent to collect a carload of material that somebody wished to pass on. They'd had it for 30 years after being a travel agent, and had acquired all these timetables for Europe, but needed to get rid of them. So I was more than happy to take them. And that's been fairly typical, that because the website has now become better known, people are offering material, which is a great help.
And I have to say, I really am a big fan of timetableworld.com, and it's helped me so much in my own research, Matthew. But how do you fund such a major operation?
Well, there are three things that have to be paid for. Firstly, I mentioned that we had our own servers. I've now moved the website to Finland, would you believe? That's where it is. So I have to pay a hosting company, but at least for reasons of stability and security, that's why it's there. So I have to pay for that. I have to pay for a storage unit for well over 1,000 timetables that are awaiting scanning.
Wow.
Then I've got scanning equipment. So some of that equipment comes to thousands of pounds. Now, how do we pay for this? Well, initially, I paid for this out of my own pocket. But what I've found is that we began offering PDF versions of the timetables. Although most of the timetables are free online, if you want to have a personal copy to own, then we make a charge for some of those. And that is really the sole income of the of website, which it has to cover those operating costs.
You've got to cover your costs, absolutely. And we're still with Matthew Shaw, curator of timetableworld.com. We heard about how you fund the storage and the scanning for the site. Can you talk with us about how you deal with the thorny issue of copyright, a subject close to my own heart in making my books as well?
So we have a number of consents in place which come about by contacting the railway organisations and asking permission to reproduce the timetables. Usually the condition is that the material is available free of charge. And so for the most part, organisations are happy to allow reproduction of what is essentially ephemera. So it's not material that is now current. A bigger problem with obtaining copyright consent is that of orphaned copyright. If I offer a timetable for Yugoslavia, who do I ask? Because the country doesn't exist, the railway organisation doesn't exist. Mm. So in many cases, there's material out there which is technically under copyright, but we've done what we can to identify the owner of that copyright. We seek consent, but we're an archive. The view I take is that the material is available on a similar basis as to if you were to walk into a public library and ask to look at the book. We're not making a charge for most of that material.
Yeah, that's absolutely understandable. Are you doing your best to contact people? But it's not always possible. So if they don't want it used, they can always ask for it to be taken down, can't they?
Indeed.
How do you overcome issues around how large all these maps are? Because they're very difficult to scan, aren't they? Do you photograph them or...?
Well, each timetable needs to be scanned page by page. So there are different techniques that we would use. Probably the most prevalent one is we have an overhead scanner, which where you just turn the pages, take a photograph and keep turning the pages. It can take time and there are challenges when the print goes into the margins.
Yeah, because you get all the kind of shadows of the gutter, don't you?
Well, the scanner I have has software that will flatten them out and split the pages. So it's all fairly efficient. For dealing with maps, we purchased a large format scanner that will deal with a map up to about a metre wide.
Wow.
So that's a big time saver. I was able to deal with a collection from the aforementioned John Davis, 1,000 scans. Well, it took a few days, but it was manageable with the right equipment.
Wow. Oh, I'd love a 1 meter square scanner. I don't think my family would be very happy about me bringing one into the house, though. You also nudged me before we started to ask you about your views on PDFs and grids. Explain that for us, please.
Well, when you think about a timetable, it's not something that you would read in a linear fashion. It's a reference book that you're going to open at a certain point in order to view a particular timetable. Whereas PDF files are essentially linear. You have to download the whole thing and then scroll to the page that you want. And some of the PDFs that we provide on the website are huge. They are a gigabyte.
Wow.
Now, we've always offered the tile pyramid concept, laying out a timetable book as though it were looking like microfiche. So you have about 30 pages going across, and then however many rows that it requires. And it, using the same tools that you would use for displaying a map online, allows somebody to browse a timetable by zooming in and out, of course, but also panning up and down and left and right. In my view, it's more akin to the way that one would access a timetable book anyway. We started out offering the grids. Inevitably, people said, well, we want PDFs. So I said, OK, well, here are the PDFs alongside. If you want those, you have to pay for them. But the grids are still available online free.
So people have options. Now, indeed. You've recently grown your operation by moving into books, haven't you?
We have actually been doing books for a couple of years. We began by selling facsimiles of timetables on a print-to-order basis through Amazon. So one can buy a full set of British Railways timetables for 1955 through Amazon. And why that particular year? Well, it's a pivotal year for when the modernisation of British Railways commenced. But more recently, the opportunity came up to publish an original book. I was working with John Davis with his map collection, and he was commenting that he felt there was a book in there and he wasn't getting any traction with regular publishers. And somehow, and I can't recall exactly how, we ended up agreeing that Timetable World would publish the book using his collection. And the important thing was that it was complementary to the website. So all the maps that were in his book were available on the website. And it would enable his book to overcome the limitations of a printed book, that you can't always zoom into the kind of detail that you would like on a map. Well, here we overcame that by saying, well, there's the same map is available on the website, and there you can do. We've been very pleased with that concept, and the book itself looks great because it's colourful, it's full of maps, you know, it sells itself.
Nice. I like the idea of a sort of hybrid, that you have something like John's excellent book and then you want to know more, so you go to the website and zoom in. That's a lovely way of doing it. And have you got any other potential books up your sleeve in the future, Matthew?
I'm working on another book with a different author, and this is more oriented towards transport timetables. It's still a few months from being available as a publication, but it really is highly complementary to what I'm trying to do with the website, in that it explains the story of how timetables came about, how they came to look the way they did. It even goes into how the adoption of time was driven by the influence of the railways. So I think it'll be a great publication, but the important thing is that it's complementary to the website. If we show a timetable in the book, it will be available on the website as well.
And if somebody looking through your website has an idea of their own, of something they've always wanted to do, which is about perhaps maps and timetables, are you open for them to come and approach you? How does it all work?
Absolutely. When you're running an archive, you're not necessarily doing the interpretation yourself. That's for other people to do. My job in curating this website is to provide opportunities, and I would very much like to work with people who will do the interpretation. And I think the only stipulation is that it needs to be related to what's on the website. I'm not going to be doing books about trains and buses. I'm doing books about transport timetables and maps that refer to the services that they run.
Focus on what you know. Honestly, Matthew, we could probably go on chatting for ages, but we have to stop. It's been a real joy to chat with someone who cares so deeply for the archives and the publications that they look after. Thank you so much for joining us today, Matthew.
Right, the pleasure's mine. Thank you, Mark.
Hope you've enjoyed listening to Matthew as much as I have. You can look at the huge range of archives that he has amassed at www.timetableworld.com. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We're doing more chatting art, transport, communications and history. Please do join us then.